Welcome to Mudifier, the show that dives into the climate crisis in Belize. I'm Andra Habet. For today's episode, I spoke to Jolie Pollard, founder, formulator, and manager of the hair care brand Ikuma. Ikuma is a seaweed-based line of hair care products that Pollard created over years of trial and error. Now, 2 years into selling her products, Pollard spoke to me about her journalism past, her formulation process, and her work with Placentia seaweed farmers whose labor forms the basis of her products. It was a great conversation with a few fun tangents. Hope you enjoy it.
Oops, sorry. I'm at home, so okay, let me go outside.
Okay.
All right. At my mom's house, actually.
Nice. Okay.
All right. You can hear me?
Yes, I do.
All right, good. Let's start.
All right, let's get going. Just so you know, it might sound like we're starting abruptly, but I'm going to have like an introduction that I'll record separately that will be a bit more concise. So I'm just going to get into the questions, all right?
Okay.
So I was like looking at the material you shared with me. Thank you for that. And you said that the origins for your products, Ikuma, was that you were trying to find something for your own hair. So I'm curious as to what was your experience with seaweed-based products before you're formulating your own? You know, did you drink seaweed? Did you use seaweed in your hair in other forms before you started to making your own products?
I had never heard of seaweed products before I put seaweed hair care products before I put seaweed in my hair. Honestly, I had no idea. So when I put it in my hair, I thought I had come up with this novel idea. Later on, I found out that seaweed has been used in hair care products. But at the same time, I still haven't found a seaweed product that is, you know, really puts the seaweed on a pedestal and targets natural hair. So I'm pretty excited about that because yeah, I had never found anything like that and still haven't. So that's pretty cool. But before I, you know, decided that seaweed would be a cool thing to put in my hair, I've been living in Placentia for 10 years now. And I think it was 2015 when I started swimming. And even before that, it was always a challenge for me to find products here in the village that would work for me because I never really ventured outside Placentia. I had a job that always kind of kept me here before. So I didn't really go to Belize City much. I hardly ever left the peninsula. So I was really limited to what was available here. And honestly, before I started this business, buying online was something that never occurred to me. I was never the kind of person who was on Instagram looking to order stuff. So I usually just bought what was in the village, you know? So the products that we have a very limited selection of products. It's mostly at the Chinese stores. We had a few things at our local pharmacy. Actually, that was the first time I found products that were formulated, especially for natural hair. And when I'm saying natural hair, I mean like natural textures that haven't been chemically processed. That's just for people who just want to like step out of the shower and just wear their hair as it is and not make it dry or so, and especially for curls. So I would just use those, but it never worked for me. Plus living in a beach village, it's very hot, it's humid. And I think that's an experience we can all share in Belize. And so I was always looking for something that would make my hair puff up or that would kind of even out my curls. And, you know, just something that a lot of curly girls like. When I started swimming every day, I started doing that for fitness. I had joined a swim group and realized that I was a bad swimmer. I mean, I won't drown if I go in the deep, but I really struggled to keep up with the group. And I was so determined to become a better swimmer. So I started going on YouTube videos and I would try to memorize the lessons on YouTube. And then I go to sea and try to practice my strokes. And I would just do that all the time until I got better and better. But then I realized, of course, that my hair, you know, was exposed to salt and sun a lot, because even though I wear a swim cap, you know, when I always take off my swim cap, salt always gets in under the swim cap. Swim cap isn't to protect your hair. A swim cap is just to keep the hair out of your face so it doesn't get in the way when you're swimming. A lot of people have the impression that a swim cap protects your hair. No, the salt water still gets in there. When you take off your swim cap, your hair is soaking wet. So I remember just looking at, man, I need some like sunscreen for my hair. And then I realized there were hair products online that had in sunscreen, like that were meant for sun protection, but they were very expensive, very specialty, you know, specialty products. And then I remembered hearing that coconut oil has natural UV properties. So I looked into coconut oil and I was like, all right, I'm just going to put coconut oil in my hair because it has a UV SPF protection of 4, which means that it blocks 45% of the sun's UV rays, but you have to reapply it like every 45 minutes or something like that. Anyway, so I started with that. And then, of course, you know, it didn't really do anything for my hair. My hair would still get dry, the curls wouldn't hold. So it was just more for sun protection. So I was like, you know, I need to do more. And so it just became like an on and off kitchen experiment. I was looking up, you know, I remember shea butter and making like a face cream, and then it kind of evolved into a hair cream. And it was not really intentional. It was really just like a side thing that I did without much focus, honestly.
How long did that first formula take you to make? The original one that became the basis for what you then developed later on?
Wow. So I would say its beginning started in 2015, and I didn't really have something special or that was really working properly until 2017. Yeah.
Damn.
And what drove me to really take it seriously in 2017 was because I was going on this trip to Guatemala, and I was, because I had quit my job. I was working as the executive director of the Placencia BTIA here in Placencia. That was my first job coming back to Belize, because before this, I was in the States working in higher education fundraising as a prospect research analyst after getting my bachelor's in journalism. Mm-hmm. So I came home, I got this job at BTIA, and it was perfect for me because I was in fundraising, and BTIA does a lot of fundraising, always, you know, all these events that we plan and getting sponsorships. And then with my journalism degree and having been the editor of my college newspaper, I was now the editor of our local peninsula newspaper, the Placencia Breeze. So I was running an office, doing that, planning events, and it's a very under-resourced nonprofit. So it was a lot to take on, and it was just me and 2 employees. Sometimes it was just one, and it was tough. It was a really tough time, and so eventually I quit. I was very stressed, and I quit. I also, to be honest, I felt super incompetent, and that's a horrible feeling for me. I always hated feeling like a failure, and mm-hmm. that job really made me feel like a failure. I took it really hard. I felt like I couldn't manage my time and all this stuff. Of course, later on, after like severe depression and all of that, I found out later on that I had ADHD, and it was undiagnosed, and it was something I had been struggling with my entire life, and suddenly everything made sense, right? But anyway, yeah. before that happened, I had quit my job, and I started working as a waitress. And my mom has a little restaurant, and she's like, you could help me wait tables, you know, until you figure out what you're going to do. That waitressing job ended up being for 5 years. So I worked as a waitress in the evenings, and I would just save my tip money and stuff. And my, you know, I mean, I was getting paid $5 an hour, just like everybody else, even mm-hmm. though I was working for my mom, but the tips were good. And I was able to pay rent and my utilities, and I would just save. I hardly went out, spent money. And then with the money I saved, I went backpacking. So that was 2017. I know I'm kind of all over the place, Andrea.
No, it's okay. No, this is good.
Okay. So 2017. I was planning on going to Guatemala, and I had saved up 2,000 Belize dollars. Took me the whole year to save 2,000 Belize dollars. And I said, okay, it's the restaurant closed. It's slow season, September. And I said, I'm going to go to Guatemala for two months. I had a friend there. And I went to Guatemala. Oh, before I went, I was like, okay, if I'm going to go backpacking or if I'm going to go over there, I highly doubt I'll find anything for my hair. So I was like, you know what? I need to improve that formula I've been working on for so long, and I need to make something that I can take with me in my backpack and that will last me that 2 months. And and I kind of just had this idea that I can take something that will work, and you know, and yeah, so I that was the idea. I'm going to take this product with me that will kind of just, you know, give me some confidence while I'm, you know, out there.
How did it work out that first time on the trip?
It was good, actually. It didn't give as much hold and definition as does now. And back then it was just a jar. It was just a cream. Now I have a cream and a gel. And so, so it was just a cream. And also my my preservation system wasn't so good. So it kind of smelled a little funny at the end of the trip. And I had also made a face cream for myself that also didn't have a good preservation system. And my face was breaking out pretty bad. And I'm like, what's going on? So no, it wasn't very good, but that's what I had with me. And so the reason I had gone to Guatemala actually was to visit a love interest, and that didn't work out. And so I was like, uh-oh, what am I going to do? Because it was like, I had only been there for maybe 3 weeks, I think under a month. And so I was like, you know, I'm not ready to go back home. I'll just, you know, wander around, see how far I can go in Central America. So I don't even know any Spanish. And
really?
I just saw,
you're brave.
I know. It was crazy getting to Guatemala. And somehow I managed to get around, and I just took the tourist trail, because I saw, you know, all these tourists, they tend to, there are these shuttles that go from Antigua, Guatemala, and then they go to El Tunco, El Salvador, and then from El Tunco, you could take another shuttle to León in Nicaragua. So I just followed, I just wow. decided to do that. So I spent time, and I stayed at hostels the whole time. So I stayed at the cheap little hostels, and I hardly ate any food. Like in El Salvador, all I did was eat. So I ate so many, what do they call, pupusas?
I went to El Salvador once too, and actually that trip made me hate pupusas, but not because I didn't like them. I had it's this whole story of my own of a friend getting sick from them, and me and a bunch of other people having to sing "She'll Be Coming Around the Mountain" when she comes in front of a group of scouts. The Lord decided to punish El Salvador for allowing us to do that by sending an earthquake. That was in 2001. So yeah, I didn't have a pupusa until I moved back to Belize in 2019, because I had such negative attitudes towards it.
That is so, and I was like, I'm never going to eat another pupusa for as long as I live, because I ate so many of those.
Did you keep to that? Did you keep to that?
Keep to what?
To not eating pupusas.
I think I had my first pupusa since then last year, because my cousin was dating a girl from El Salvador and she made some, and I was like, okay, I'll eat it. But I've never bought one. There's nobody in Placentia making them, but yeah.
You come to Belmapan, I'll get you some pupusas. There's some good ones here.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'm ready.
Yeah, so you went to El Salvador and you had all of that, and so when you came back, were you like, well, I'm gonna put some more time into this, or was there a gap?
So I came back home, and again, it wasn't the focus. You know, I'd come back home and I was like, you know, I need to start writing again. I think BTIA had come back to me and be like, okay, we know you quit, but would you be interested in doing a newspaper again? Just the newspaper. You don't have to do anything else. And then I was like, all right, fine. And so I did the newspaper for a year or two. And then I also tried doing some freelancing, but I was really struggling. I was just horrible at my time management. And then, so I was freelancing again when I just kept experimenting with this stuff. And I think my mom was like, you know, you should try and sell this, you know, you should order some jars or something and see what you can do. And it was just kind of mentioned, and I was like, I don't know about that. So I kept thinking that, you know, I felt embarrassed that I was a journalism student who graduated magna cum laude from a Jesuit college, all this stuff. And you feel like you have to live up to that.
Totally.
You know, I really felt like a complete failure in Placentia. Like I felt that I had disappointed the Jesuits, I felt like I didn't deserve my scholarship, because here I was in Belize, not fulfilling what I thought I would be, you know? I mean, that's how I felt.
Just to get into that a little bit more, I'm very empathetic to that, you know, in the sense that I actually first intended to study journalism and then didn't pursue it because of some conversations I had with elder states journalists, not encouraging conversations, more so, I guess it gave me an impression that to be a journalist in Belize was to trade in violence and sensationalism. And I was like, I'm not interested in that at all. And so that's why I didn't participate in it. But I'm curious as to you know, your sense of what do you consider to be success in journalism in Belize, and how did you trace that for yourself?
Oh, wow. As a journalism student, I used to follow the Belize news religiously. And all I could think about was, I want to go home and change it. I want to make a difference. I want to do a better job in journalism because I know we could do much better. And I really wanted to pursue investigative journalism because mm-hmm. I saw so many stories that would be covered. And then, you know, nobody was held accountable. And then it would just go under the rug. And I was like, if only yeah. we could just stick to a story and get to the bottom of it until it's done. And, you know,
yeah.
It was kind of hard when I ended up running a little village newspaper, and a lot of it was obviously I was working for the Belize Tourism Industry Association. So a lot of people who were supporting a newspaper and buying ads in our newspaper were real estate companies, and our members were hotel owners, resort owners. And so that's what we were doing, was like publishing the articles about these businesses and everything. And so for me, you know, it wasn't what I thought I would be doing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it was enjoyable because I would cover community stories, or I would see that my stories would make a difference for some of the businesses. You know, we they were proud, they'd be so happy to see something in the paper, and, you know, so there was some gratification, but I always felt a bit unfulfilled. And so I I've come to peace with that. It was a struggle, but I think I'm finally at peace with the fact that I didn't make it as a journalist.
Yeah, I think maybe you should commend yourself for that, in the sense that if you were successful here, that might have just meant that you were popular more so than effective, right? I think there's a lot of journalism that gets a lot of attention, but I wouldn't consider it to be doing what I think, you know, journalism should be doing, which is holding people accountable, like you stated before.
Yeah.
And it's something that sort of, you know, I've also thought about that, you know, this podcast itself, you know, I see it as a platform to get at some questions, but the thing is that a lot of people who are in positions that can offer answers are just so avoidant of even engaging in a conversation because they are well aware of either their lack of answers or their lack of good answers, you know, of answers that actually they can reveal without punishment for themselves. Hashtag whistleblowers, I guess.
Completely understand. Yeah. And that was, as you know, when you're idealistic in your 20s, that was my dream. Like, I was like, I don't give a shit. I'm going to go home and just do all the whistleblowing. So there was one point where I think in the midst of all my stress and unhappiness, I just impulsively started this blog. It was a satirical blog called Penis of Belize, because my grandfather used to joke that Plasencia Peninsula was the penis of Belize whenever you looked at the map.
Oh, that's really good. I like that.
And I jut out at the bottom.
Yeah. So, very, very limp penis though, right? Very limp.
Oh, yeah. So the whole blog was a very attention grabbing blog, but I was pointing out a lot of problems. So for me, I was, when I came home, and I mean, I'm from Belize originally, but Plasencia was my childhood family vacation destination growing up. So when I came back from the States, I just, you know, every time when driving down the road and seeing a real estate sign like every few yards, and just watching the locals being displaced, and just feeling this huge cultural shift was a lot for me to take in. And it kind of brought me down a lot. I personally felt like a huge identity crisis, especially working for the BTIA, where I'm kind of in the middle.
Yeah.
You know, I'm friends with all these foreign investors, and then I see what they're doing, and I see the development, and I see how they give back. But then I also see the envy, and I felt a lot of tension between the locals and the foreigners, and it was very, very stressful for me personally. And so I ended up starting this blog called Venus of Belize, and I just kind of poured out my feelings about real estate. And I remember in the blog, I said, every time I see a real estate sign, I just want to break it into pieces and jump on and smash it in the ground. Like,
oh man, I love that. Is the blog still live? We still have the archive up? You still have the archive of the blog?
No,
up?
I had a moment where I just deleted the whole blog. But
Oh my God.
But in 1 week, I think I had 10,000 views. It was crazy. Yeah. And I even made my own like little caricatures of the, like in one blog that I wrote about real estate, I remember talking about the people who owned land, like had the erect penis, and the ones who didn't have land was like the limp dicks. So it was a cartoon, like with the... Yeah, it was a twisted blog, but it got a lot of attention. So that was a lot of things for me to reckon with. And then there were times when, you know, I'd be accused of being a hypocrite because then, you know, I'm having these thoughts, I'm saying these things, but, you know, people see me eating at a foreign restaurant or I'm dating an American restaurant owner. And, you know, so it's like, well, who are you? So it was just all of that was a lot. And I was just like, oh, who am I? What am I doing here? I'm so confused. I just want to escape from all this and haul my ass out of tourism. And so for me, getting into Ikuma has been like an extremely liberating experience.
Yeah, I can imagine so, because it also puts you in touch with an entirely different sphere of people for the work you're doing. You know, now, from my understanding, you work along with seaweed farmers for the major, you know, product that you use, the major, I guess, ingredient to your product that you use. And I'm curious as to, you know, the ways in which like you fostered that relationship with seaweed farmers, and also, I guess, how has it changed your sense of like your relationship with the sea, I guess, more broadly, and your relationship with how you see natural resources?
So I remember the first time I heard about, my grandfather, we grew up drinking seaweed milkshakes. My granddad used to make seaweed milkshakes at their restaurant because my grandparents had a restaurant here in the village since the 70s, right? They've since passed and my mom runs it now. But so we grew up drinking seaweed and his shakes were really popular. And I just remember hearing growing up that, you know, seaweed was always promoted for, like, we knew it as it was delicious and we loved the drink, but health-wise it was always a very patriarchal perspective that it's strong for the body and good for men's sexual health.
Yes.
Of course, since then I found out that it's actually equally good for women's sexual health and our overall health in general.
All right.
I know. Come on, guys, get it right.
I know, right? You just have to, that's the problem, right? Like, guys used to think, you know, I remember the advice used to be, you drink a seaweed and a Guinness sort of like back to back, but I guess, you know, now you just have to buy two and then everybody can have fun.
It's funny. Actually, when I was working for the BTA, because we would plan Lobster Fest, Art Fest, and these different festivals, I had proposed once that we have a strong back festival and we would promote our seaweed industry and we would get Guinness or Stout to sponsor us.
I love that. That's a fucking good idea. I like that a lot. And
they were like, Joey, you have too much on your plate. You can't handle that. I'm like, that's an idea. Anyway, maybe they... You know, and then I was thinking, like, we as our slogan and our t-shirts, we could have put it back.
Oh my gosh, I love that. I think 2022 is the year for that. That's gonna happen next year. You got my support. I'm gonna buy a shirt.
I hope so. I really think they should do it. But yeah, you know, so other than my granddad's seaweed milkshake, I remember like I went to as a journalist, I got invited to a lot of community meetings. So there was one meeting with the Southern Environmental Association and JAPS, or, you know, popular seaweed farmer who unfortunately passed away earlier this year. He had given a presentation. Now, anybody who sees JAPS just see this dread guy would walk around barefoot, you know, he likes to drink and hangs out at the bar. You know, you might not think much of him, you know, if you have your stereotypes about Rasta or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And this man got up in front of that class and he started talking about the seaweed project and seaweed farming. And I remember just sitting there like completely blown away. Like, wow, this man is so freaking brilliant. Like, he could be a college professor easily. You know what I mean? Like, so much respect immediately for him.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he was talking more about farming. And then there was a man in the room. He passed away. He's a very a popular entrepreneur in Belmont, Richard Harrison, the man who started Big H.
Mm-hmm.
He was giving a presentation, I think, because he was making some seaweed peanut shakes or something. And he was telling us, you know, that, you know, it'd be good to get into this industry. And I think a lot of the talk then was like, we need to produce seaweed so we can export seaweed, because there are a lot of industries around the world who want to use seaweed and they want to make cosmetics with it and blah, blah, blah. And it, honestly, I wasn't even thinking like, hey, why don't we do something with it? Like, yeah, beyond the milkshake. Really, in my mind, it was just like, milkshake, Belize. I wasn't even, and other people outside will do more with it. Never occurred to me like, hey, we should do something more with it. So, it's been like a slow budding relationship with the seaweed farmers, again, because I think when I started this product, I think I would even go as far as calling it a bit of trauma living here and having to walk over the eggshells, being somebody who worked in tourism and being in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was like, automatically, I just felt like, oh, I feel like people probably hate me. I feel like I'm this Belize City girl who came up here with this cool idea. Maybe I'm going to make money. And, you know, like, I was really nervous and was so scared about what people would think and all this stuff. And then after I started my product, I had heard that there was a woman, seaweed farmers, and they were supported by the Nature Conservancy. And then they kept telling me, you should join the association. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I want to join. Like, I was so protective of what I had created. And I felt like I didn't trust anyone.
Yeah.
Like, people are like, you should sign up for a bell trade. I'm like, I don't know, I heard bad things. Like, you know, I was just, I was so, so protective. And I also knew I was broke as hell. I didn't have any money to invest in the business, no money to patent the product. I emailed a couple of lawyers and I found out how much money it would cost, roughly $25,000 to patent.
$25,000?
Yeah.
Is that patented only nationally, or is that an international patent?
I think it'd be an international plan, but it's through the Belize channels, you know, hiring mm-hmm. a lawyer here and getting it done. And I was like, screw this. You know, I really want to do this. I don't want to wait. And part of me felt like, that's a bad idea. But I just said, screw it. So that's why I really attached my name to the brand. I attached my face to the brand. And I really tried to put myself out there, because I figured, well, if anybody wants to copy or recreate what I did, at least I can have my help, you know. So that was the idea. And but I find myself now opening up more, being less guarded. Luckily, one of the girls who's a project manager for the Women's Seaweed Farm Association, she messaged me and told me about the seaweed training, and I went out there with them and I had the best time. I'm just, all of these seaweed farmers are so smart. So like, you know, what they do out there, just the physics of the whole layout of seaweed farming is super impressive. All the thought that goes into tying the ropes and putting the, you know, having the lines underwater and having everything, you know, properly installed, so that, you know, it's just, there was a lot that I didn't know about. I thought I knew, had a general idea. And then the more I explore, I'm just like, wow, this is incredible. So, I think it's a really amazing industry. And so more and more, I just get excited about having the potential of being, you know, a key player in making it bigger and having all these people benefit more from it. Because the more product I can produce, the more seaweed I can buy, and the more they can benefit, you know?
Yeah, so, totally. I'm curious as to that aspect of things in terms of what you were just saying of scale of production. And, you know, your background is in journalism, and I'm curious as to how you came to understand and see the path forward for growing a business that is so heavily reliant on an ingredient, a resource that requires a lot of labor. And, you know, we're still in the relatively early stages of seaweed farm production here compared to other countries. You know, I was reading earlier about the prevalence of seaweed cultivation in a lot of East Asian countries. And I'm curious as to whether you've been in contact with other farmers, like, or other producers of seaweed products internationally, or how have you come to understand the future of your company based on what is possible with a finite resource.
Yeah. So when I started, I knew immediately when I started this that I would be fully committed to supporting my local community. Like, there is nobody's going to change my mind about that. Like, I am going to buy Placentia seaweed, and now I've actually opened up. I'm like, okay, I'll buy Belize seaweed, but first I put them first. I want to support them first. If for some reason I can't get seaweed from them, then I'll look to other sources in Belize. Like right now they're trying to do a farm in Ternes, and I'll be happy to support them, but first I try to support people here. And the other thing is, and I again, from day one, from my first purchase of seaweed, and I was getting seaweed directly from Jeff's, I was like, it didn't even cross my mind to ask for a deal. I was like, I'm going to pay exactly what they deserve. So it's $30 a pound, which is pretty pricey. We're talking in Indonesia, a pound of seaweed is like $2.50.
Whoa.
It's so cheap. It's so cheap because number one, they grow their seaweed along the coastline. So they don't grow it all the way out like we do. And what that does is because they grow it along the coastline, they have like huge seaweed farms. And then you see all the boats parked out there in the farms. So we're talking about a lot of contamination from gasoline. We're talking about contamination from fertilizer runoff from land. So I was at a seaweed conference, a virtual conference a couple months ago, and Julie Robinson from the Nature Conservancy, who have been a key part of developing the seaweed farms here, had talked about how really, honestly, we have some of the best quality seaweed in the whole world. And it's true because of how we're growing it. And there's so much care put into it. Placentia people are very conservation minded. They're very eco-conscious. So like, I was shocked. This is something I just posted on my feed today, actually. I was very shocked when, you know, Mariko, who's the woman, the president of the Women's Seaweed Group, said, you can't put on any sunblock, no sunscreen, because when you go in the water, you know, the seaweed absorb nutrients from the water, and we don't want any air sunblock going on. You know, so they think about everything to make this product as high quality as possible.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Our seaweed is clean. There are like no contaminants. That's why they grow two species. One is ecuma, that's how you say it.
Yeah.
And I just gave it a Creole pronunciation for my brand, ecuma, because that's how we say it here. And then there's Gracilara, and Gracilara, they're both red species, red seaweeds.
What's the difference between them and their use?
So Gracilara is better for consumption. It has more nutrients. So they're both equally, they're both very nutritious, but Gracilara is supposed to be better. And so, and it also doesn't gel as well as ecuma, and it's the gelling properties that make it excellent for cosmetic use and industrial use as well. But for when we're talking about like for supplements or, you know, food, Gracilara is a better one. So I use the ecuma. Yeah. So I've been in business 2 years now, and I paid $30 a pound. Even if I buy 10, 15 pounds, I never tell them to give me a discount. And when I went farming with them recently, and I see everything involved in this, I'm like, that's my commitment. I know that they get requests from people abroad, and of course, you know, people in big business abroad will be like, I want so much off, you know, and they're like, we work hard for this, you know, so I totally respect that. And I know that TNC has a vision of the farmers also creating byproducts. There's a lot that they could do. So
yeah, definitely. I'm interested in that, and also in how people can use sargassum into making products. I'm particularly interested in sargassum as a building material to make bricks, which is something I've seen done in Mexico. One question I have here is I'm really curious about your take on. I feel like you were one of the first, but to make like products in Belize using Belizean ingredients. And then I feel like in the past, I moved back to Belize in 2019, but I feel like even since then, there's been like an explosion of Belizean made products. And I'm curious as to what your thoughts are on that, whether you think this is sustainable. And I'm also very curious about one aspect of things, which is that you list your products, ingredients, and that's actually not the norm, it seems.
Yeah, that was, I remember, I think it was my dad who told me, why the hell you put your ingredients on your label? What are you thinking? Like, you know, you didn't even get your thing patented. And I say, you know what? When it comes to curls, because my product has been, that was how it started. It was supposed to be for curls. Although now I have people of so many different textures who like the product. And so in the future, I'm thinking I might expand beyond curls, but for now, that's what I'm doing. And I was like, Dad, as a curly girl, and I know people with natural hair, the first thing you do when you pick up a product is you look at the ingredients. So that's really important for us because we want products that, you know, are sulfate free, paraben free, you know, don't have any alcohols, like all this stuff. And we care about that. And I was just like, you know, I'll put it out there. And for me, I think that was actually a good thing. I think that's why people like it, because I think customers value transparency. Mm-hmm. And so I was willing to take that risk. So I did. Yeah. But you're right. After Ikuma launched, and I think a lot of people saw, wow, like somebody made a cosmetic brand in Belize and it's actually seems to be doing well and everybody's recognizing it. Right after that, it was just like, yes, a huge explosion. Like so many different cosmetic brands locally just started just popping up everywhere. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. So yeah, that was really cool to see.
It's interesting the different ways that people can see the blooming of an industry, because I've even, you know, in Belize, the crap culture mentality we talk a lot about here, there is sometimes this notion that if one person does something and then somebody else does something, not even the same thing, but in the same industry, it's seen as some form of theft. And I guess I always think about this in terms of the ways that capitalism unconsciously puts us into this competitive mindset in which if you have one thing and I have the other thing, then that ultimately puts us at odds as opposed to potential collaborators. So I'm curious as to whether you and other people who are making these products
I'm not gonna lie.
Mm-hmm. Tell me. I want to know the truth.
I do have that competitive spirit. I'm not gonna lie. When I see someone else doing something a lot like mine, I get pissed. I'm like, God damn it, seriously? We have a freaking small market. And it takes me, I have to calm down and I have to be like, okay, this is not the right approach, not right. I know it's hard. You really have to try and be like, okay, be the better person. But it does get under your skin. But this experience towards me, I'll tell you what happened to me. This was horrible. So I had just started and I was really surprised, like, you know, right after launching the brand and the website and everything, I got attention very quickly. And Cherise from Channel 7 was down here in the village. It was my birthday. And she was like, I'm down here in the village for something. And I want to interview about Ikuma. So we did an interview. And I was watching the interview on Channel 7 on Facebook. So the live newscast where people are commenting. Mm-hmm. And this one guy commented and he's like, she the lie. She teeth that salon. So apparently there was salon. Yeah. Apparently there was some salon owner in Belize City who had been using seaweed to make like a leave-in treatment for hair. So like a salon, it would be like for people with chemically processed hair would put this stuff in and then wash it out and blow dry their hair or whatever. Completely different concept from mine, right? I had no idea. I mean, he left the peninsula. Then this guy was writing like, I know, because I see she at the salon. She always dance. She made it ask up the gal, but and I was like, what the fuck? I don't even go to salons. I'm too broke to go to salon. And I remember just shaking like, what the hell is this about? And then, and you know, people on Facebook immediately gravitate to the negative side, right? So everybody really? Just immediately jumped on this person's comment and was like, oh, she's a horrible person. Man, why Belizeans have to be so disgusting?
Oh my God.
Teeth out of people saying, you should tell a young lady you need for patent the thing, copyright the thing. And I'm just sitting there like, holy shit. And so I commented and I was like, you know, this is a lie. I don't know what you're talking about. I have absolutely no idea who you are, you know, I just freaked out. And then I called a friend who works with PR and I was like, this thing happened. I don't know what to do. And he was like, ignore it, just ignore it. And so I had people messaging me saying, hey, like there's a lot of comments about China's Channel 7 newscast. And I was like, I'm not looking. I'm not going to look. I do not want to look. And I remember for like 3-4 days after that, I couldn't sleep. I had so much anxiety. Like my stomach was hurting me because I just felt like this person was out. I felt like this person was just out to destroy me. And you know, and then I, yeah, got over it, picked myself back up and continued the business. And that was a learning experience early in the stage of the game. And the same person I had talked to said, get ready, because this won't be the last time.
Jeez. And how has your response to that sort of messaging changed since then? Are you more capable of ignoring it, or are you still on comment threads defending yourself?
Honestly, to be honest, I haven't had an incident like that since then. That was I had just started. I launched a brand in August 2019. And I think it was that later that same year that whole thing happened. And since then, not to my knowledge, you know, it's been pretty positive. And I have like amazing support from people, even my customers. Like early on when the product, I had a food preservation issue at the beginning, and like a couple of people like had made a product went bad on them would send me a personal message and be like, hey, I really love your product, but this is what happened. And I just don't want you know. And I was like, wow. The fact that I'm never gonna put that up on the Weave Business Review or something, you contact me personally, I was just like, man, thank you so much. And that happened several times. So I don't know what kind of energy I'm putting into the universe, but it's all good vibes that I've been getting so far.
How dramatically has the shelf life improved of the products?
So in the beginning, my emulsification method was not very good. So what would happen is like the preservation, the preservative that I would use, which is a globally approved preservative, by the way, one of the most expensive formulations. But a big part of my commitment to my brand is not just buying local seaweed and paying the premium price, but also to give my customers toxic-free ingredients, right? Mm-hmm. Because when I started, I was using a preservative that contained propylene glycol, and another ingredient that can produce very tiny amounts of formaldehyde, which can be very sensitive for some people who are very sensitive to it can mm-hmm. feel a little bit of irritation. But most people were fine. But that never sat well on my conscience, because I was just like, you know, I really want to be a green brand, an eco-conscious brand, and the fact that I was using petroleum derivatives in my product just felt dishonest.
So anyway, but
aside from that, my emulsification process wasn't so good, so that the preservative wouldn't distribute evenly in the product. And so for some people it would be fine, and then for some people it wouldn't be fine. So when I improved that method, my shelf life is now extended to 6 months.
Damn, congratulations. A question I have connected to that in terms of developing an eco-conscious brand is something that I'm very curious about in general in Belize, which is mm-hmm. which is the difficulty of packaging for Belizean made products. And Ziania, who I mentioned I interviewed last about her product, Longevity, mm-hmm. she and I have spoken at length about the difficulty in her accessing bottles for use with her product. And I'm curious as to what has been the trials like for you in terms of getting packaging, and also the difficulty in that it's very hard to get packaging that is not petroleum based for products like yours.
Exactly. So when I started, I only had $300.
Damn.
I started my business with $300 on my credit card. My credit card has like a max limit of 1,000. So I only had 300 left, and I carried almost down to zero just for buy packaging.
Wow.
And and I was like, I have to buy plastic because that's the way affordable. Mm-hmm. So I got plastic, but again, I didn't feel good about it. So I remember like very early on posting on my Instagram page and like in my stories, I was just like, guys, you know, I know I'm using plastic, but this is not my end goal. If anybody has any ideas out there, I really want to make this better. Glass is very difficult because a lot of my customers would order and I would have to ship to them. And once I ship with glass, the mm-hmm. price, the shipping cost is ridiculous, right? Yeah. So it's, you know, they almost pay double what the product costs. So I had put that out there, and a girl responded to the post and was like, hey, there is actually a grant opportunity right now for small businesses who want to reduce plastic in their line. Like, you should do it. And I only had, I think it was like the deadline was in 2 days or something. And I jumped on it and I won. So it was a $3,000 cash prize, Belize dollars, to invest in biodegradable packaging. And then I was also supposed to go to London for the Commonwealth Litter Conference, because it was sponsored by the Commonwealth Litter Program and facilitated by TIDE, right? Toledo mm-hmm. Institute for Economic Development. So when I was looking for packaging, I needed to find something that was going to break down. And so I had to be careful. And also the grant committee, they were also looking at what I was considering as well. Like, they had questions like, what is this really gonna work? So anyway, I ended up settling on these pouches from a company in Canada called Tech Pack. And so they're really cool. They once they come into contact with microbes, they start to break down. And if marine life consumes the packaging, they're okay. So that is what mattered to me. And so that helped to ease my conscience a bit, just to have this option to my customers. But the fact that I still use virgin plastic materials, that's not something that I'm willing to do forever. So I don't have the money yet. I'm a startup, you know, I've only been in business for 2 years. I'm broke. maybe I shouldn't say that, but anyway, I'm just being real, you know.
And, yeah, totally. It's the reality of things. You don't have venture capitalists plugging in millions into your business.
No, that's not happening. So it's really my everything, that all the money that I make goes right back into the business. Like, I won't go to the bars in Pleasant Say. You hardly see me eating out because I stay home. I'm not going away. So, yeah. And then with COVID, you know, I'm like, really? And I guess the COVID never changed much for me, because I was on lockdown before lockdown became trendy. So, yeah. I was already socially distancing. So so all the money goes right back into the business. And so it's just trying to grow it bit by bit, which is what I've been doing. Having read a lot of books on entrepreneurs and heard stories from different people around the world, you know, I feel like I'm on the right track in that regard, because I really believe that if you take on investors too early, that can be a big mistake. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that I was committed to avoid, and just kind of learn how to discipline myself and really commit to it, you know, before that becomes an option. So the next step for me, one thing I'm going after is to start using ocean plastic. So that's plastic that's collected from the oceans, from coastlines, and then made into plastic containers. So that's the next step. Ultimately, I would like to use completely biodegradable packaging, but I haven't really found anything yet that I think will work for my products. So and these things are expensive, you know, and that's one of the unfortunate mm-hmm. things that I'm very accessible to a lot of Belizeans, which I love about my product, because I love that I'm able to offer people at home a product that is good, that's high quality, that's natural ingredients that you would pay double or triple the price for abroad, right? I know that it can be a higher value product, but I love that it's accessible. And so, you know, that's one of the next things with packaging too, is, you know, will the price have to go up? So all of those things are, you know, what I have to consider in the future. But I think right now we all have to try and do our part for the environment. So, you know, plastic is not the end goal. That's
just a stepping stone to the real thing. What you want. So my final question then, you know, touches on the issue of the environment. And I was looking into seaweed farming, and I was very curious as to how seaweed industries were being impacted by climate change, by increased temperature, both terrestrially and in the marine environments. And I saw that in the case of one country, at least Tanzania, that they had been severely impacted by climate change, and that there's far fewer seaweed farmers there than there was just, you know, 10 years ago. So I'm curious as to how these conversations are occurring within your industry in terms of how to upscale at the same time when, you know, the impact that the fossil fuel industry has done. Just for our audience's reference, ExxonMobil is responsible for the majority of plastic produced. And so I'm curious as to what your take on that is and how you see things going on. Are you okay? You said shit like twice, and I don't know if it was because of what I was saying or because of what's going on with you.
My first experience with nature and the availability of seaweed was a hurricane last year. Mm-hmm. We didn't have seaweed available from September to March. Whoa. Luckily, I had bought just enough to stretch for a while. I had to kind of go easy on my advertising, and I had to, you know, just try and just make just enough, you know, to keep the brand alive until I could get seaweed again in March. So that was one thing that I realized, that, you know, I have to make sure I could buy enough before hurricane season, because we don't know what's going to happen. And seaweed is so delicate, you know, it's tied on the ropes, and it's we do a special knot to try and secure it to the ropes when it's in the water. But if it gets too rough out there, they can just rip off the ropes. So that's another thing to consider. And I think that's the problem with scalability, is that your investors want to know if you have a secure supply of seaweed. And so that's another thing too, why I prefer to just keep it a small business, an artisanal business, and not jump the gun, because those are all things that we have to look at, especially if you want to commit to your local seaweed industry. Because I remember when the hurricane happened, people were like, well, you know, maybe you could buy seaweed from somewhere else. And I was like, no, I'm not gonna do that, because that's just, you know, I'll lose my integrity, and you know, I made this commitment. And so that's the tricky part. But I think at this stage of the game, I'm willing to try and see what I can do to stick to our supply. But you know what the future is, and Israel has already started on this, which I think is very smart. They are now doing indoor seaweed farming. So they have a controlled climate environment inside a building, and they are growing seaweed like in a big lab setting. And they've extended their operations to the Netherlands as well. So there are two plants, one in the Netherlands and one in Israel. And so they're able to really control all the variables, which is pretty cool, because then you can really make sure that you're growing a high quality seaweed. It's under your watch. It's like a greenhouse for seaweed, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, if things get in the future, if we're, you know, we're really struggling with climate change and how it affects our seaweed growth and everything, we're going to have to depend on seaweed that's grown inside in a more lab setting.
Yeah, and we're going to have to also find a way to match the energy needs for spaces like that, because if that's happening to seaweed, then of course it's going to be happening to other crops that are necessary for us to consume. This brings to mind you know, the increasing frequency of blackouts in Belize, and how Belize is not really matching the energy needs of consumers, which is only increasing as climate change makes it warmer and makes it hotter, and therefore people need to use more cooling devices just to stay sane. Right now during this whole interview, you know, I usually take off my fans so I can do the interview, and people ask me to do this show as video, and I refuse to, because they don't realize that to get decent audio quality, I am standing and sweating the entire time I talk to someone. And I do this to give good audio quality.
People don't recognize
that's what's happening.
and you know, and so this,
well, thank this you for is... your sacrifice.
That's a contradiction with my that I have to deal with right now, is that, you know, my key ingredient depends on a healthy climate.
Yes.
And the fact that I'm producing it in plastic feels awful, right? So that's why, like,
the contradictions of capitalism, yeah, man. Yeah. You just have to live in them and not. Yeah, but you're trying to find a way forward with it, and you know, some people don't even do yeah. that, and I try really hard to bite my tongue and not call names here because I don't want to talk shit about people, because I save that for people in power. But it is cool to know that, you know, the when you think about the future of your company, it is not just growing it in terms of how much you're selling, but also growing it. You mentioned integrity more than once, and I think that's something that I wish more people would center when they think about growth, is how can I grow my integrity? How can I grow into that?
Yeah, it's called social capitalism. I know capitalism has a really bad stink to it, but I like the concept of social capitalism, where it's like, yeah, you know, you can build a business, you can make it profitable, but you do it in a socially conscious way, where you're fair to the players involved. And you're not just out to, benefit and profit off the misery of others, you know. So so I think there's a way, you know, that we can earn profits, but doing it in a good way.
Yeah, and I really hope that the trajectory is set out there for you to continue to make that happen in a way that benefits both you and your community. Well, that's all the questions I have. And thank you for giving me so much of your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Andre. And I think I said a lot more in this interview than I have in others. So, but yeah, these days I don't mind. I mean, I think it's fun to be open and let people know what all is involved, you know?
If you like the show, please subscribe and consider writing a review for us over on Apple Podcasts, as it helps to increase the show's visibility. If you write a 5-star review, we will read it in a future episode. If you have a climate crisis or environmental story impacting Belize you'd like to discuss, you can contact us at matafaya@gmail.com or message us on Facebook or Twitter at matafaya. And be sure to hit that follow button. Thanks to Alexander Evans for providing our theme song. You can find him on Instagram at Alexander Evans Music. And thanks to Devmi Williams for providing our artwork. And thanks to you for listening to Matafaya. Don't forget to join us next week for another episode. Rest when you can, and find some shade. Thank you.